you see a new article every day, the robots are coming after our jobs, and by 2030, we're all going to be out of work. And there are all these sort of ideas out there that I think are stupid.
Welcome to We're Only Human, a podcast focused on blending research and practical advice to help today's HR, talent, and learning leaders improve business outcomes. Let's welcome your host, Ben Eubanks.
Greetings, everyone. This is Ben Eubanks, your host, and I am so glad you're here. The summer is quickly passing us by, and I'm enjoying a few weeks home with the kids. It's been a truly interesting summer, and I'm working on a handful of projects to shepherd them to the finish line. The book is on the final round of edits. I think I've said that a million times, but apparently there's no end to the process ever. My team is building some new HR certification study tools for those that are pursuing their HRCI or SHRM certifications. That's all going well. And on top of that, I have tons of webinars and speaking events coming up. Staying busy. I'm talking about everything from performance management to artificial intelligence to compensation transparency. Bottom line, I just wanted to thank you for spending some time here with me today and listening to the conversation. I talked to a lady earlier this week at one event, and she said that she drives 75 minutes each way to work every single day. And when I asked her how she spends her time in the car, she said, well, I listen to talk radio or something mindless. But I encouraged her to pick up a few HR podcasts. You might know a good one, at least on the way to work, to help kind of sharpen her idea, sharpen her mindset, get her mind in the right place. On the way home, I said, listen to whatever you want. But in the morning, it's the rudder of the day. It steers the rest of your life, and we need to be careful not to squander it. Speaking of life, let's jump into today's topic. What does it mean to be human? With all the discussion of robots, AI, and machines, is there a clear delineation between what humans can do and what software can't? In today's discussion with the inimitable Danny Johnson of Red Thread Research, we discuss some practical ways employers can look at weaving more human components into the work they're doing. Danny's research shows that things like collaboration, storytelling, and creating a vision for the future all tie into this innate human quality of work. But how do we take advantage of those tools to create better workplaces and performance for our people and for the business? I've got to warn you, we nerd out a good bit, and the conversation truly is a fun one. I know you'll enjoy it. Now, on to the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to We're Only Human. This is Ben Eubanks, your host, and I'm so glad to have you here today. You know, every once in a while, you meet someone, and it feels like you've known them forever. And I recently attended an event, this analyst event, and I spent some time talking with Danny Johnson. And on the second day of the event, one of the other attendees said, hey, you guys, you know, you get along well. How long have y'all known each other? And we kind of laughed and said, well, this is our second time to meet ever. And they told us it seemed like we were old friends. And I took that as a compliment to and a testament, I guess, to Danny and how approachable she is. So I love those moments. And I also love that she's willing to join me today on the podcast to talk about some of the work she's been doing lately, some of the research and some of the things she's been exploring. We had a brief conversation about it at the event. I want to dig into it deeper today, and you guys get the benefit of kind of listening in on that. So, Danny, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Ben. I really appreciate being able to be here.
Absolutely. So, to kick us off, other than your name, no one else knows anything about you, or they might. Tell us a little about who you are, what you do, how you spend your time.
Yeah, so I'm an analyst. That's how you and I met. I'm an analyst, and I focus mainly on how organizations learn and how organizations move people around, so career paths within organizations. I had been at Person by Deloitte, if anyone is familiar with that organization, up through February. And then in February, my partner and I, Stacia Garr, started a new firm called Red Thread Research. And so we're doing many of the same things in sort of an updated and more interesting way. So we conduct research on basically human capital practices in large organizations, and then we keep track of the vendor space as well to figure out what's going on there.
Absolutely. Awesome. So that's the world that I live into, so I love it. I have a question for you about the analyst thing, but before we get to that, tell me something that you love to do when you're not researching, writing, speaking, teaching, doing all the things that you do at your day job.
Yeah, so I'm sort of in love with my bicycle. I'm a cyclist. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I'm within 5 miles of Five Canyons. So in my spare time, when it's not 100 degrees outside, I am on a bike.
Excellent. Very cool. I'm not a cyclist, and we talked about that when I was there. I'm more of a runner than a cyclist, but I have a lot of respect for the cyclist, not just for dealing with all the crazy stuff on the road, but also just because it's a tough sport. So when I get tired running and I'm going up a hill, I could just stop and walk. When you get tired going up a hill, you just have to pedal slower but keep going. So it's a little bit different. So Very cool. So one of the things that you and I kind of talked about a little bit before is this idea of what an analyst is, what an analyst does, because it never fails. We were sitting at that event, and I don't know if you remember what the woman said. She was an HR executive at a firm, and she said, "Hey, you know, I've been listening to you talk and kind of share your expertise and your opinion and everything, but what is an analyst? I don't even know." Do you get that question often? And if so, how do you answer that? Because sometimes I have a hard time translating it to what it actually means for some people. So tell me a little bit about how you respond to that.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, I get it all the time. My family doesn't even know what I do. I would love your take on this too, because I'm not sure I have an elevator pitch down on what an analyst actually does. But we talk to organizations and we talk to vendors in the HR human resources space. We try to find commonalities or threads between ideas. We share best practices, and then we do research broadly, not necessarily for one company, but broadly to try and figure out what the trends are, where the human capital practices or the people practices need to go in order to help organizations succeed.
Excellent. See, that sounds much more polished than the one I come up with. After I do,
well, I want to hear yours.
I do a couple of let me see. Because part of it depends on who I'm talking to as well. When I'm explaining it to my almost 8-year-olds, it's daddy just writes, baby. Daddy just writes. Okay. That's much easier for them. And they're all excited about that prospect of me writing something that they would ever read. And that's probably not going to happen. But, yesterday I was at an event. I was talking to a couple of employers and someone asked me, "What do you do?" And I said, "What we do is we research what companies are doing in their talent practices, and we try to find out what the best ones are doing so that we can help other employers improve how they're operating, basically." So kind of a similar to what you had said a little bit about understanding the employer piece of that. I rarely talk about the vendor piece unless that's the conversation that I come in on. You know, if they're talking about, "Hey, we're looking for a vendor, or we're using this, or we don't like who's doing our payroll," then I'll lead in like, "Oh, you know, talk to a lot of vendors, happy to share some insight with you," or whatever else. But I don't always lead with that, and I probably should, because they're, in a lot of ways, they're linked together.
Yeah, we see it at Red Thread. We see it as sort of a, I hate to use this word because it's an 80s word, but now I don't even know what the word is. We see it as a mutually beneficial sort of relationship to be able to talk to both groups, because they need each other, obviously. But also because the vendors have a really good sense. I mean, they're always sensing their market, so they know kind of what's going on anyway. So we see them as a huge source of information, as well as just being able to talk about their products effectively and intelligently.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they do it from a different angle a little bit, but they do the same thing that you do in terms of talking to a lot of employers, talking to a lot of prospects and customers, and they're always trying to, the best ones at least, right, are always trying to understand what they're dealing with, what their challenges are, so they can try to solve them in some way. And so I like hearing those things from them, because it helps me to get another filter, another lens on those kinds of things. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of ask that like meta question, because I always kind of trip over that a little bit. And it's funny that I can talk to, I mean, I expect an employer that has, you know, 100 people or 500 people, I expect them to be a little bit unsure. When I talk to employers that have 10,000 people and they're like, "Yeah, you know, I've kind of heard about the analysts, but I don't know what they actually do, what they are." That's when I'm like, that surprises me, because a lot of the research and things we do, and, you know, the vendor side, those are companies more likely to be using those kind of resources. And to run across people that don't know what an analyst is, or what they do, it still surprises me.
Yeah. You know what? I'm not sure. I mean, I don't want to belabor this point, but I'm not sure I understood what they did until I became one. You know what I mean? I'm not sure it was a job that I ever even considered, because, I mean, there are so few of us in the world. I don't know. I mean, we don't show up in any ICS, so I don't know.
That's an interesting point too. I think I'd go with that one. That's probably a good example, and we'll transition from there. But I like the idea. Until you do it, it's hard to explain what it is, right?
Sure.
Anyway, cool. So one of the things that you and I chatted about at the event, again, I keep going back to that because it was the last time I saw you face to face, and it's like a family get together almost, when we all get to see each other, hang out for a little while, and then you don't see each other for 2 or 3 months, and suddenly you're back together again. So I keep referring back to that. But one of the things you and I talked about, we got on AI a little bit, and that kind of became a discussion point for the group. But one of the things that I was really interested in, and I heard you talk about, was this concept of how AI and humanity, what it means to be human, kind of trying to define that, because I told you there, I just finished working on the book and have been digging into what this means for the HR profession more broadly. But I'd loved your kind of your explanation of what AI is, what humanity is, and kind of how you define human. Can you talk a little about your research on that? Because I think it's just really an interesting point to help us define what that looks like.
Yeah, for sure. I started thinking about this because there's so much fear-mongering going on right now with respect to AI and robots. And you see a new article every day, the robots are coming after our jobs, and by 2030, we're all going to be out of work. And there are all these sort of ideas out there that I think are stupid, basically. First of all, because I think the human race is smart enough to figure it out, but also because it's sort of a false fear. It's clickbait, basically. And so I started looking into it a little bit, like what separates us from the apes and what separates us from the robots. And we've always sort of seen that on a continuum, like the robots are on one side and the apes are on the other side and we're in the middle, but that's not actually how it works. And so I started digging into the psychology research because obviously your book isn't out yet, so I couldn't have read it. I started digging into some of the psychology research to see, you know, what had been done over the years as far as defining what the characteristics of being human is, or the humanness of people. And I've run across basically four things, and they all sort of stem from this idea of episodic memory, but four things that humans do that have basically put us on top of the food chain that the apes don't do at all, or don't do very well, and that robots still can't do. I don't know that they won't someday, but I'm pretty sure that they won't. And those four things, they kind of boil down into four things. The first one is being able to picture a different future. So if you think about robots, they have no interest in picturing a different future, and they can't. And apes don't either. They subsist sort of day to day living their lives. But humans can picture a different future and then go after that future. They can create something in their minds and then go after it, which is a uniquely human characteristic. And I think one that has gotten us where we are today. So that's number one. Number two is this idea of storytelling. There's been some recent research that indicates that apes have a little bit of storytelling, but we use stories in ways that other animals don't and that robots never will. And storytelling is great because it's not just a way of sharing information. It's also a way of sharing emotion around, events that have happened or events that will happen, or painting that picture of what that future can look like. And so, storytelling is the second one. The third one is the one that actually surprised me the most, and it's this idea of collaboration. And I think it's interesting to talk about collaboration and the political climate where we are today, just basically in the world. But, it turns out that humans will collaborate much longer than it's personally beneficial to them. So apes will communicate as long as it's beneficial to them, but there's very few instances of altruism in apes. Humans do that. They collaborate. Robots will never collaborate. And then the other one, that is, I'm calling it my sort of half point because there are instances of animals that do use tools, but we use tools. We have sort of elevated the use of tools to a fine art. We use them not just to change our world, our physical world, but we also use them to change our mental worlds. So if you think of all of the tools that we use in managing people and especially in teaching people, those are all tools that don't necessarily change our physical world, but they change our mental space. And that's something that robots don't need to do. And that's something that apes don't do. And so those four things, the storytelling, the collaboration, the picturing a different future, and the use of tools, are the things that really did, you know, that have leveraged us to this point. The things that we have leveraged to put us at the top of that food chain. And I think they've been underutilized quite a bit in the last 100 years. 100 years ago, we started caring a lot about efficiency, and we've been using people as sort of cogs in a machine almost, instead of leveraging the things that make us unique and put us at the top of the first place. What do you think?
Interesting. Gosh, I love that. So I want to go like point by point. Let's discuss a little bit, because I think all those are worth like a whole discussion themselves. So the vision, we got to figure out a shorter version of saying being able to picture the future, a different future, but like, I don't know if it's vision or what it is, what to call that. But one of the things that, again, you said employers don't always do this very well, but the research shows, and even like practically, one of the things that I usually talk to people about, you know, in performance management, for example, is if you don't help those people that work for you, if you don't help them envision a future where they're part of your company, they're going to envision themselves somewhere else. And so like, that's a piece that I like, it translates directly to this common sort of concept of let's help someone envision a future, whether it's in casting a vision, where you kind of get them wrapped into where we see the company going and where they play a role in that. But you said employers have backed away from some of these things in the last however many years. They're not doing them very well, and so they're missing out on that opportunity. Any practical ideas for kind of how that wraps into what an employer can do to kind of engage their people or to kind of help them to – maybe it is just as simple as helping them see that future there. I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there's been a change in a sort of a shift in the last 5 years. I did some research when I was at Burson, and if you're members, you should definitely read it, about sort of career management and how organizations are defining career management, how people move in and out and through the organization. And there's been a shift. So it used to be sort of the company decides how you're going to move through it, and you just jump on that bandwagon and off you go. There has been a shift in the last probably five to seven years where the employee is actually more involved in that process, which they definitely should be. Leslie Block wrote a great book, Work Rules, that has some of the things that they do for their employees in there, that Google does for their employees, that really involve them. And the second thing that I'm seeing is the future isn't necessarily defined within the walls of the organization. And that's something that's pretty scary to the organization, but I think it's something that's necessary. So you may fit here for a while, and then you may move on to something else, and that's cool. And I actually talked to one organization that said, listen, not everyone's going to be CEO, and then we got to quit telling them that they're going to be CEO. So we tell them when they come in the organization, hey, we want you to learn and grow and develop, and we want to get everything out of you that helps our company move forward. And the minute that isn't a mutually beneficial relationship, we want to help you find something else that's going to be beneficial for you. And because they're doing those sorts of things, we're seeing sort of the rise of alumni networks and things like that, where people are brought back into the organization at a later date when they have different types of experiences or when they have expertise that can be leveraged within the organization. So we're not losing track of people, and we're not breaking up with people, so to speak. We're making them part of our extended network and using them in organizations where they fit. Where it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Right now, I'm totally blanking on the name of the company, but there's a company in Colorado that they're not a startup anymore. But when they started up, they had these people come in, would work with them as technical people, and those people kept leaving the company and going to start their own firms. And they're like, "What in the world? What are we doing wrong?" And then eventually, they said, "Hey, we should own this." And so they changed their branding from, come here and work forever to come here and learn what you need to go and start your own great company, because they started seeing all of these other great companies they were creating, not as competition, but as potential collaboration points.
Yeah.
And they said, hey, these people, they're successful. They're doing what they did, not just because of their smarts, but because we helped to teach and grow them and give them the right culture and the right components so that they could go and do that. And so they started kind of marketing themselves as that thing, because then they get the benefit of all those really sharp people that think, I don't know if I want to start my own company or not, but maybe 2 or 3 years from now I might. So I'll go work for a company that supports that, versus the company saying, come here and we're going to take all of your ideas. We're going to own all of those things that you create. We're going to lock those things down and try to keep you here with a non-compete as long as we can.
Yeah.
They took that opposite approach, and I love the idea. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but right now it's just completely slipped my mind. But I used to talk about them in the context of this internal ability discussion that you brought up, because I think that's a critical point. And we always think we need to keep them. We can't let them leave.
Right.
It might be that they leave or they come back, or they leave, and then that becomes another point for the company to collaborate with and support kind of long distance.
Yeah. I don't know if you're seeing this, Ben, but I'm wondering if sort of the walls of the organizations are breaking down. Mm-hmm. We hear of gig workers and things like that, and I think that's had a definite impact on it. But I'm actually wondering if, like, the more organizations that adopt that kind of mindset, the one that you just described, if it's actually going to become more of a network, more of a cooperative way of getting things done versus, within the same walls. We own the people, and within these walls, we will do things a certain way. Because I actually think – actually, go ahead. You're going to say something.
No, you're good. Keep going. I'm loving this thread.
I actually think that's the way that we're going to have to do it in the future. I don't think that we can afford to hold on to people as tightly, or we as organizations can't afford to hold on to people as tightly as we have in the past, because it doesn't work anyway. Mm-hmm. And And so if we can switch our systems, so maybe we're ramping them faster or giving them more freedom to do what they need to do in the organization, it gives them a chance to sort of envision the future that they want and be beneficial to the organization while they're there.
Well, not to get too nerdy, not that we're not already like neck deep in it, but I think that you mentioned the gig economy piece of that. I think that's one of the drivers. One of the other things that I have watched and kind of been interested to see in the last few years is I talked to a company, a founder of an assessment company a couple of years ago, and his vision was that someone would take that assessment and that assessment would follow them through their career. The person would own it, not the company, not the employer. You know, if I have all my new hires do an assessment as the employer, I kind of own that data. But instead of me owning it, the employee owns it themselves, and they could, you know, if I go and apply somewhere else, I bring that with me. And so you get to see, here's who I am. You know, here's my resume, but here's who I am as a person using that assessment that's portable and following them around. And, you know, maybe that comes with your learning stuff. You know, the things that you're picking up and learning and understanding, are those things following you? And so I think those kinds of changes in the technology side help to enable that too.
I totally agree. Like there's been, I was just having this discussion yesterday about XAPI and whether it was actually a useful thing. It's a way of sort of classifying data, learning data, so that it can travel. And it gets to a much more granular level than we've seen in the past. But I totally believe that. I think that there was a great piece written. Shoot, I don't even know who wrote it, so I'm not going to say. There was a piece written about the resume and how the resume is becoming sort of more 3D, a much better sort of indication of what a person, who a person is and what they can do. And a lot of that is because of the portable data. We're also seeing like credentialization is becoming a thing. You'll be able to take skills with you, degree, PathGather, who just merged, EdCast, Cornerstone even, are allowing people to put their data in a learning record store instead of having the company on it so that they can take that information with them, which is exactly to your point. I think it's becoming more of a thing that allows people to have more control over their future.
I love that. I love that. And I guess in a conversation between you and I, we couldn't help it from being too nerdy, but hopefully everybody else is enjoying this as much as we
are. Of course it's going to be nerdy.
Again, we're talking about kind of the future of work, though. We're talking about what things look like. We're not doing it in these fluffy terms, but in terms of real, like, these things could change, and these technologies, some of them already exist, and they are enabling people to be more – people to be more portable, you know, the skills they have and everything else. So let's pick another one of those points that you talked about a minute ago, storytelling maybe. You mentioned, you know, like emotion sharing. First thing that popped in my head was, you know, we tell stories. A couple years ago, I worked for a company – and on the first day, you showed up at the office and you did your tax forms and all that other fun stuff. But then you sat down with the CEO, the founder of the company, and he talked to you about why the company existed. Not about, you know, like, oh, here's my grand vision for the future, but like, here's why you are here today. You are going to serve this role because this company needs that. And this is why the company exists. It's who we serve and who we take care of and the mission and all those things. He shared that in a story form. He talked about his history in the military. He talked about the things that he had done and the people that he had served there and the issues and problems that he had and how he thought that he was going to try to solve some of those problems for those same people because now he's on the other side, you know, as a civilian. And that story, that was 2010, 11, and I can still vividly remember where I was sitting, you know, how he was looking into my eyes and talking to me the whole time because it was so compelling. And I think storytelling is a critical thing. I actually recorded a podcast recently with our friend Molly Lombardi talking more about storytelling as kind of a skill. That was a good lead in. But talk a little bit about that piece of it, how you see that playing out, maybe how some of the listeners can get better at using those or look for points to use those in the employee experience so that it's a real tool, not just a thing where we go through everything. We're like, oh, yeah, we'll layer a story on top of that and hope for the best.
Yeah, we're actually seeing a lot of that in training. They use scenarios and things in rote page turning training and think that they're doing storytelling, but that's not really what it's about. I think the way that you described it was perfect. It's about the sort of the transmission of emotion to help somebody understand motivations and purpose. As you know, there's lots of conversations out there about this idea of purpose. Like purpose is something that the younger generation tends to look for a little bit more than maybe the one above us did. And so transmitting that emotion is really important to help people understand the motivation for staying in a place or doing what they're doing or understanding the importance of their job. So I think, like, I've seen it implemented in a couple of spaces in organizations that is actually pretty cool. One of them is a music streaming company who's, I don't have permission to use their name, so I won't. But they have their senior leaders tell stories. Just like you sat down with the CEO and he told his story, they have senior leaders tell their stories of how they ended up there and what their career path looked like and why they're there. And then they share those through small podcasts so that people have access to them when they're looking for ideas about where they want to go with their future. And I think that's a really effective way to do it, because what they're basically saying is, hey, you don't have to follow the rules here. There's not a list of things that you need to accomplish in your career. Here are a bunch of leaders in our organization who have taken random and very different paths, and they've gotten to where they are. And so, you know, sharing that emotion and why they're there helps a ton. Another organization that does this really well is Medtronic. They share customer stories with their organization in ways that, you know, obviously their product changes lives and saves lives. And so it's sharing those with the larger employee base gives people a purpose for being there and gives them that purpose and that motivation to continue doing their job.
Absolutely. Well, that reminds me, there was one of my favorite books that I always recommend, and I know you're a reader, The Frontline Leader. It is by Chris Van Gorder, and he's the CEO of Scripps Health Network. And that's one of the things that he does is he will go and he'll sit down and talk with, you know, a child who had cancer that was treated with their people. And he'll actually bring that child in when he's meeting with, you know, the nurses or some other part of the staff so that they can see, like, this child here is alive because of you. Not because of anything I did. As a, you know, I'm the CEO, but I didn't do anything to save their life, except for try to stay out of your way. You know, you're the reason that this child is here today. And he talks about in the book how that's such an emotion. No one walks out of there not without tears in their face. But it's that same thing. Like, you can't. It's easy to get bogged down. If, you know, if you're a nurse, you're doing a checklist and everything else, and it's easy to get bogged down in, like, the day-to-day stuff. And so taking those moments to resurface the why, the reason, the purpose, as you mentioned, that is a critical point, I think, that you can't do it one time. You know, you can't say, okay, this is the reason we're here. Now go get to work and I'll never talk to you again. It's got to be kind of this thing you revisit on a regular basis. You mentioned the podcast piece with the senior leaders in that company. I think that's a great example of this needs to be a continuous thing, because if you ever let someone get too far away from that purpose, that why, they'll start to just see it as just another job, just another task. And then when that recruiter calls from a competitor, they're more likely to listen to their story than if they had just walked out of that meeting or thinking, heck no, I'm not going over there because here I really matter. I'm making a difference.
I like that a lot.
Excellent. Excellent. Love that. I'm trying to think if there's another one on your list. You had collaboration, you had tools. You want to dig into one of those? Pick one?
Sure.
Pick one, whichever one you'd like to dig into a little bit.
I like them both so much. let's go with tools.
Okay, excellent. So you talked about training a little bit there, right? Tools to teach and manage people, yeah. Like on the technology side, things like that. Talk a little more about kind of how you see this playing out. And again, going back to the same thing I've said every time, I think. Let's talk about some practical impacts and things that can understand and hopefully apply when they're thinking about this concept of, hey, I'm a human. I've got tools at my disposal. Now, how do I really make those matter?
Yeah. So reading the psychology research has rocked my world a little bit. I'm an engineer by education, and so I was educated to deal with the physical world. And so reading some of this stuff has been really interesting. Like the company is not a physical thing. It's an idea, right? And so pretty much all of the technology that runs a company or that a company uses that isn't necessarily geared toward building a physical thing is a tool that we use to create, I don't know what, I don't even know what you call it, an entity, like an idea. And if you think about that in terms of the people aspect of that, all of the tools that you and I talked, you know, all of the vendors that we talked to and the tools that they create, that is all used to create this sort of fictional entity that exists in the space and in the idea, in the minds of people, but doesn't really exist anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what is most interesting about that particular aspect of being human, is we have now evolved to the point where we're actually creating tools to mess with our minds or mess with the space in our minds in ways that robots don't, and the ways that, that chimps definitely do not either. And the reason that I like that is because we know from talking to so many vendors the impact those tools can have, particularly with some of the other things that we've talked about. So the collaboration, the piece, the picturing a new future piece, and the storytelling piece, we see tools every day that help us do those things better. I'm going to stop there.
Interesting. I was going to say, when you said that, it made me think about tools is almost like an enabler for some of those other things, because you're talking about this in terms of, we think of software as a tool that we can use. It really enables some of these other things. It enables us to tell better stories and connect that into people and share that and distribute that. But think about software as a pathway for helping organizations to share that, you know, the vision, whatever that, whatever we're going to call that, being able to picture different future, software and the tools and everything else enables these other things. And so you called it your half point, but it might be just as important, more important than the others, because it really enables those things to have a bigger impact than they would otherwise. If we were storytelling purely based on what I gave as the example a minute ago, this face-to-face one-on-one, that's hard to scale when you have, you know, 50,000 employees around the world. But if we have the technology in place to help scale it up, distribute that, all those other things. So I think that's how I, not that it negates what you're saying, but that's how I kind of see that tools piece, is it really is the kind of the capstone to help all those other things have more of an impact than they would otherwise.
You know, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely right. I have nothing else to add to that.
In the words of Forrest Gump, that's all I have to say about that. All right. I've got the Alabama accent and everything to prove it. So really quick transition and short, because this conversation is all about you and the work you've been doing. I don't want to talk about the book much, because everybody's probably tired of hearing me talk about it, and I'm going to continue to probably forever. But one of the things that I cover in the book is that got us talking about this topic there, actually, at this event, was I said that I have a chapter dedicated to kind of the core fundamental human skills of work and the skills that you need to develop if you're going to quote-unquote future-proof yourself, you know, to some degree. And it really kind of aligns with some of these other things you've talked about. And so I looked at a bunch of research, looked, you know, industry research, academic research, trying to understand what those things should be, and came up with five kind of soft skills that run the gamut that we all can be developing in ourselves and in our workforces to help us stay insulated to some degree from this increasing automation, because it's harder to automate these kinds of things. And those five things were creativity, collaboration, curiosity, compassion, and critical thinking. All the five C's, easy to remember or really hard. But you know, creativity, being able to come up with new ideas and things that don't exist, that ties in really well with some of the things you're talking about. Collaboration, obviously a point there. Curiosity, asking questions about things that don't exist. Compassion, and really having some empathy and a feeling for the people around you. Hard for a robot to pull that one off. And then the last one was critical thinking. And right now I'm totally blanking on the example that I give in the book for that one. But basically being able to work through a problem instead of just doing the quick, hey, Google, what's the answer to this question? Because there are a lot of questions that you and I run across that are not as simple as a Google away, which is why we do what we do. You know, we spend our time and effort and everything else digging into this. I'm curious, any of those stand out to you as, hey, that's a big one, or any of those that you want to push on a little bit, that we can debate, whatever you want to do, I want to give you a chance.
Yeah, no, I don't think I would debate any of them. The one that stood out, though, is curiosity. I think I study engineering, or I study education for a living, and I've sort of dipped into K-12 and university as well. I think the last 100 years have sort of done a lot of our students not a favor, because we don't encourage the curiosity as much as I think we need to. And if it's something that we're going to need in the future, which I totally agree it is, we got to figure out a way to foster that that curiosity. I would like to know from you, you know, how do you see that happening in organizations? How are organizations encouraging that curiosity?
You know, one of the ways to do that is to really encourage people to ask questions. You know, how many times do we someone asks a question? I remember this in my own career. It's like, we don't know the answer to that, so you probably should just go back to work and not ask that question ever again. So it's a lot of like, hey, we're in the day-to-day. We're busy. I mentioned that a minute ago, you know, and we just don't stop to surface and say, hey, why is it like this? Has anyone ever said this process is not very well run? We should probably kind of explore another option for this, and just asking why. Maybe it comes from having small kids. But there's a book that I love. It's called Brain Rules, and it's by John Medina, and he talks about a couple different concepts that are kind of fundamental in neuroscience things. And one of those is that humans are powerful and natural explorers. And when I talk about informal learning and how we kind of drive our own learning in some ways, because we are always curious as humans and innately, I use it to kind of explain that. But one of the things he talks about in the book is, you know, millions of years ago, humans were hardwired to be explorers in a physical sense, you know, migrating around, looking for food, things like that. But today, it's just as much mental as it is physical. If you've ever had that moment where someone asks a question, you're like, I don't know. You know, Google's right there at your fingertips. You can search for an answer. But that satisfaction you get from like, I've got to think through this. I've got to figure this out because I can't, you know, look that up and take the easy path. I had that with a song the other day, some old, you know, commercial. And I'm like, I've got to remember this. It is a point of honor that I don't, you know, fail this test in front of the entire world. Just me and one other person. Like, you can't tell what it is because she Googled it. She's like looking like, I'm going to tell you. So I just think the idea of curiosity and really encouraging people to ask questions and question things. There's another book. If I want to keep pointing out the books, I'm going to give you a reading list today, basically.
I've written them all down.
Another book that I love is called The Idea-Driven Organization. And they talk about how to solicit ideas, you can't. Obviously, you know, some of the ideas you'll get if you start soliciting ideas from your people are not going to be good. Sometimes they're not. But sometimes they can be revolutionary. One of the employees that we had years ago, we were selling this piece of technology for basically it was a radio simulation kit. So the military uses these really sophisticated radios that are hard to understand, encryption, everything else, security on them. And so instead of giving someone an actual physical radio to play with and potentially break and pulling it out of service, we sold these simulators that looked like it, felt like it, and did everything it did, except for it was just a piece of hardware and software. And one of our employees said, hey, you know what, we're selling these things, but then we have to come back later and update them and everything else. Why don't we sell this as a license? And we sell it, and every year they pay us a fee, and we are always on call for support. We can help them if they need training, you know, everything else. And it became a multi-million dollar line of business for the company. And it was just the idea that she had, and this is years before all the subscription services we have now. This was, you know, 7-8 years ago before a lot of those things were in place. And she said, hey, we're spending all this time and everything else. It was just an idea she had one night when she was driving home from work. And so being able to let people know that being curious and being able to ask questions and being able to throw that out there as an idea that may or may not be taken, but knowing that at least, you know, we'll consider it and we'll you know, give you some closure on whether we took it or not and then understood it. I think that is really important from a cultural standpoint for employers because, again, I've worked for companies where it was purely about you get the job done, don't ask questions, don't say why, don't question the way that we're doing this. We just are marching on, and it gives me a little bit of satisfaction knowing that company ultimately shut down because they had that sort of they had that sort of approach. I hate it for everybody that worked there, but I was like, you're shooting yourself in the foot when you have 600 people that could be idea generators for you that are sitting right here, that are on the front lines, that are right there next to the work and able to show you and share with you ideas about how to improve things, and yet you choose to ignore all of those things, thinking that a handful of executives removed from the actual work that's being delivered, removed from the customers, they're sitting in their offices elsewhere, that they have the best ideas. That's fallacy.
Stupid. Yep. I totally agree.
I'll say
I love
stupid.
That example.
I love stupid. I'll say stupid. You've used it twice. I've got to use it now. I've trained my kids not to use that.
They
but
can stand it.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that because of your kids or because you don't like the word stupid?
I can't. I don't use words that I don't tell them not to use. So there we go.
Pretty good.
There we go. That's as aggressive as I get on the language side. So.
Okay.
So anyway, that's curiosity in a nutshell. There's other examples and everything else. There's another book I would point out. There's all these different things I could share with you. But that's like the idea of curiosity as a thing. And that section of the book is, again, going back to my kids, the section of the book starts with why. Like, if you've got a toddler, you hear this 87 times an hour, and it's something that we stop asking as much as we get older. I don't know if it's because it's trained out of us or we know more or whatever it is, but for those people that are always kind of asking and pushing, not in a in-your-face kind of way, but in a, I am genuinely curious about why this is the way it is, and I don't understand it, and I want to understand it. I mean, that seems like it's a natural extension of, like, the way that you would operate. You said you were an engineer by trade or by training, right? That's a natural extension of that, it seems like, the way that you would kind of approach the world.
It definitely is. I wish it were more prevalent in other disciplines. I mean, that's how engineers get stuff done, right? We're curious about stuff. But I wish that were true for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah. Thank goodness for engineers and for you not being an engineer anymore, right? But being what you are. Because I think the conversation would have been very different today if I was talking to Danny the engineer versus Danny the
it definitely would have been.
Research ninja over there. Oh, goodness. Okay, so this has been so much fun. If someone wants to find out more about you, more about Red Thread, maybe they want to learn more about Stacia because she's the better half. No, I'm just kidding. If they want to learn more about Red Thread, learn more about you, where's the best place for someone to go to do that?
Yeah, so our website is probably the best place right now, www.redthreadresearch.com.
Okay. Excellent. Awesome. Danny, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. I have enjoyed it thoroughly. I've probably got more laughs out of the conversation than any other meeting or interview or anything else this week. So I appreciate you spending some time with me, with the audience, and kind of sharing your expertise.
No, this was great. Please have me back again. This was a really good time.
Okay. I will take you up on that for sure.
Okay, sounds good.
For sure. To everybody else, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Danny, and I will catch you next time on We Are Only Human.
Thank you for listening to We Are Only Human. Please take a moment to share this episode with another HR leader who might see it as a valuable resource in their daily work. For more information about the podcast and to see all our show archives, please visit upstarthr.com.